my experience has been oftentimes if you give the other side the chance to speak and you're actually willing to listen and willing to consider that maybe they have a point, you'll find out that often they do have a point. And so I guess like that's for me the interest in engaging with Orthodox people and visiting an Orthodox church is like, well, I feel like these people have something to offer to me as an Anabaptist, other than, you know, wholly abandoning my upbringing and running after.
Welcome. I'm your host, Aaron Beachy, coming to you from Kokomo, Indiana. And today on our show, we're going to be talking about our experience of visiting an Orthodox church. And today, of course, we have again with us John Baylor and David Baylor, brothers as always. And yeah, still brothers. They haven't given up on each other yet, but we had the opportunity to visit an Orthodox church a little while back, and we just want to share a little bit about our experience and maybe share a little bit about how we feel as though the experience could, you know, inform and maybe help us learn a few new things about our own church traditions and things like that. So, David, I think I'm going to have you kick us off here.
Well, like Aaron said, we took the opportunity, I guess it'd be about a week ago, to go and visit an evening service in an Orthodox church. It was kind of for the purpose of experiencing a different tradition. And I think like a lot of us, like us three, were of the same mind on that. Like, rather than looking at somebody like the Orthodox or the Catholic Church, groups that those, especially of a Protestant background, but also us from a Anabaptist or a Mennonite background, will often look down on those traditions and say, you know, we added a bunch of things or come up with a bunch of things that aren't in Scripture, or, you know, they're the product of a corrupt Christianity. And so
I think that's the historical way of thinking about it, but I think in contemporary times then there are a lot of Protestants who would think, you know what, I'd just rather be Orthodox.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think kind of what I'm describing.
Well, I mentioned that just to say, like we're not doing either one of those things. We're not here to, you know, to criticize. Go visit the church and say, like, okay, here's all the things that I didn't like about it.
Yeah, well, okay.
I mean, for the most part, if there's things that we didn't like about it, then there are things that we don't understand. And I put understand in quotes because I think rationally we understand them. But like, but maybe there are practices that, even though I understand it, it's not my thing, and that makes it hard for me to really engage in it. And because I don't engage in it, that doesn't mean that it's bad or whatever.
Yeah, okay, so let me back up. Like, what I'm saying is, you know, this might be the questions that our viewer have, is like, well, why would you visit an Orthodox church? Like, you know, they're Roman Christianity, you know, this is Constantine's Christianity, they've added a bunch of stuff, they compromised and corrupted Christianity and did all these things. You know, they have icons and you know, talk about the Virgin Mary and the saints and all of these things. And so I'm not bringing this up to say, you know, these are objections that we have. I'm just, you know, anticipating, you know, these are the kind of questions that might pop into somebody's mind. It's like, well, why would you visit an Orthodox church?
I know, but following that same thinking, I'm thinking, wouldn't the viewer just think, oh, so they're going to convert to Orthodoxy?
Right. Well, the answer, I think, is no.
Right.
I guess what I'm putting out there is just the perspective of maybe that's not a healthy attitude for us to have. Maybe some of the assumptions that we have regarding like a huge portion of the Christian world, like the majority of the Christian world, actually. If you put Catholicism and Orthodoxy together, you've got the majority of Christianity. And we can be dismissive of them and very critical of them. And I, like I said, I think we're all three of the same opinion that that's not really a good attitude for us to have. and oftentimes leads us to treating things in the Christian tradition with a sort of skepticism that cuts us off from receiving blessings that we might be able to receive. And so, like, for me, like, that's my interest in, I guess you could say, reaching out to the Orthodox. Like you said, oh, these guys are going to join the Orthodox. Like, well, I'm not looking to leave our Anabaptist tradition and leave that behind, or necessarily to change our Anabaptist tradition, or to, you know, to be critical or to try to come up with some kind of hybridized Anabaptist orthodoxy or something like that. But at the same time, like, I think it's good for myself, for us as a people, to be open and to be open to the fact that, you know, just because something looks strange to us, just because we don't understand something to us, just because we can't immediately come up with a justification or an explanation for something that another Christian tradition is doing, doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong or unbiblical or something that was made up. My experience has been oftentimes if you give the other side the chance to speak and you're actually willing to listen and willing to consider that maybe they have a point, you'll find out that often they do have a point. And so I guess, like, that's for me the interest in engaging with Orthodox people and visiting an Orthodox church is, like, well, I feel like these people have something to offer to me as an Anabaptist, other than, you know, wholly abandoning my upbringing and running after.
It sounds like part of the drive is because if you visit the Orthodox Church, then you personally get the experience of stepping into something that's different, mm-hmm. without condemnation, which is sort of a rare experience. I mean, like, the normal way is when you encounter an idea that doesn't align with your idea, then you attack it.
Right.
But now you kind of, like, set this trip apart, or there's other ways where you set this particular interest apart and said, no, I'm going to set condemnation aside.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, there's a kind of pleasure or, like, intrinsic goodness that comes just from the act of setting condemnation aside and just listening.
Well, I shared this, I guess, separately with both you guys in talking about this experience after the fact is, you know, there can be a tendency, and, you know, I've even heard other Anabaptist speakers, like, really confused why it is that some Anabaptist young people are interested in Orthodoxy, and, you know, quite a number of them have actually left and joined Orthodox churches.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, some people, like, stressing out, like, why would you go there? You know, like, sometimes in our mind that could be like, well, that's as wrong as you could go. And, you know, and just, you know, this whole litany of complaints and criticisms. And, like, kind of what I shared with both of you guys was, like, well, Paul says to the Romans apparently were having some kind of a dispute about their doctrines and how they were practicing Christianity and, you know, the specifics of it. And Paul gets into that a little bit, and what he says to them regarding that, you know, they were fighting about that and arguing about it. He said, who are you to judge another man's servant? Like, he's telling the Christians, it's like, who are you to judge another Christian who's the servant of God or the servant of Christ? Like, that's not your place. And I think that's a good reminder for myself and a good reminder for us. So I'll admit sometimes I can become critical of, for example, evangelical Protestants. And I have to apply that same measure there. It's like, who are you to judge another man's servant? Like, these people are trying their best to serve God, and you're sitting here criticizing. Like, that's not a Christian attitude.
Yeah, I think, and this can maybe draw us back, because hopefully we'll talk a little bit about the personal experience of, you know, mm-hmm. visiting this church and our impressions and all that as part of the discussion. But I think those people, and you mentioned Mennonites specifically, but this is any group of Christians or Protestants, if they leave their tradition and they join Orthodoxy, then It is true that there's there are some ways in which the Orthodox theology is developed that may be very appealing. Mm-hmm. But people aren't leaving Protestant traditions and joining Orthodox traditions for doctrinal reasons. And like I said, I don't want to rule that out entirely. But the reason that they're going to leave is because in the Orthodox tradition, in the experience of being in an Orthodox church service, then you see that there is, I'll even frame this as belief, but there is belief in sacredness, mm-hmm. and the value of sacredness. And when you walk into the building, then you feel like this is a sacred place.
Right.
And you know, like as you go, like I mean, you enter the building, but then you go into it your name, right? I mean, I don't want to misuse some of these terms because there are different outer chambers there.
Yeah.
But you move into the nave and you're like in a totally different space. And you've got all these paintings all around and candles burning and
that'd be the narthex.
Okay. Yeah, those are the two that I didn't want to switch around.
The nave is like the main.
Okay. Okay. So then you come into the narthex then.
Right.
And again, you're in a totally different sort of space, and you're not to, I'm still going to misuse terms probably, I'm just going to call it the sanctuary. Mm-hmm. But you're not in the place where your service takes place.
Right.
But you're still in this place that's like, that is telling you, get ready. Because yeah. you're about to undertake something very serious when you walk through these doors.
Well, and like, I'll say like, you know, it was kind of the same for me. You know, like you walk into the church that we visit. It's not the first time, I think, like for neither of us, it's not the first time we've visited an Orthodox church. Mm-hmm. But I would say probably for all three of us, it's probably the most Orthodox church that we visited. Like the most like fully developed building that we've mm-hmm. been in. If that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
that like you know you walk into the building and there's like the entryway where the, you know there's the bathrooms and you know maybe there's some classrooms and some stuff, and it's just kind of like you know walking into any other church almost, and you know there's just nothing remarkable about it other than like you know I guess there were like some stained glass windows or something that you wouldn't see in a Mennonite church,
mm-hmm.
definitely. And then you walk into the narthex to the
entryway. Although also from the exterior you have
yeah.
you have architecture that is beautiful and is also out of place. I mean, I was about to use the word foreign, but I say out of place because like in a sense that's part of what sacredness is like you come into a sacred place and you're like, this is something that doesn't fit into the pattern of this world, you might
right.
say.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you like you walk into that narthex, the entryway into the church, and it's just like right when you step into that, it's just like that's when it like really struck me. It's like, wait a minute, this is a different world. Like I've just entered into something that is set apart and separate from the world that I engage in. And it's like I appreciate my church. And I'm not saying this to put my church down, but it's like you don't have that experience in a plain Mennonite church. You know, it's possible to go into the sanctuary in our church, or like, you know, we're in the sanctuary of a Mennonite church right now, and it's like it's possible to enter into this space and it just be like any other space. But it's like that was the thing that was striking about that church we visited, is that is just not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's by design. That's the way they want it to be that way. They want it like you step into this place, you're stepping, like, how should I say this that doesn't come off wrong? Like you're stepping into God's temple, but not in the sense that this is the only place where God is. Like the whole theology they had around their worship is that when you enter into worship, you're entering into the presence of God. You're entering, in some way or another, into the heavenly host. Like the architecture, that's the idea behind it.
Yeah, into the beauty of holiness.
Right.
And, you know, I think of both beauty and grandeur as part of the experience. Now, I do think there's something similar if you walk into a Mennonite church, but it's not the beauty and grandeur. Because I think our architecture and our sanctuaries tend to be very focused on simplicity,
right,
and humility. And to go ahead and put an Orthodox word to it, I think that our architecture and our sanctuary design in that sense is an icon of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
We've got this visual representation of something of the nature of Christ, and therefore something of the nature of God. But again, it's very different than the beauty and grandeur of the Orthodox Church. But I think that you were sort of saying this, it's like it's impossible to not see that when you walk into the Orthodox Church.
Right.
And you can walk into the Mennonite Church and not see. I mean, maybe that's just the nature of simplicity and humility, is that it can go unnoticed quite easily.
Right.
But I don't know, maybe there's also a sense in which we could be more clear with the message that our buildings are preaching.
Well, so I'd like to back away, I guess, from this topic a little bit, back to something you said earlier about, you know, when people leave an Anabaptist or a Protestant setting and go to an Orthodox church, they're like, they're not going because of doctrine. And, you know, like, that would be generally the reasons why people go from one Protestant church to another, mm-hmm. or why people go from an Anabaptist church to a Protestant church, is like, because
their beliefs align with mine.
Yeah, right. And what's striking to me, and I guess what kind of caught my attention about Orthodoxy in comparison to Anabaptism, is that, like us, their emphasis is not on doctrine. And it's really not even on theology, but rather it's on practice. And, you know, like that might strike some listeners who know something about Orthodoxy, that might strike them as sounding odd, because, you know, a lot of people will think of Orthodoxy as like, oh, it's the state church of Russia or Greece or all of these countries, and so you're just Orthodox because you were born Orthodox. It's like that can be true, and it's a problem, I would say, a lot of Orthodox, like a lot of devout Orthodox people are aware of. And I would guess before you get too carried away with that, realize like that's also true of Mennonites and Protestants, that most of us who are Mennonites or Protestants are that because that's the tradition we were born in. That's the culture.
Yeah,
although
my experience was that the issue of having people come to your church that you know don't really believe in any of it.
Mm-hmm.
Always to me seemed like that was more common in other traditions than it was in the Mennonite tradition.
Yeah, that might be true. I guess I don't know a whole lot for sure, definite facts on that.
Well, I think you could see, and I'm going to Catholicism here rather than Orthodoxy because we would be around a lot more Catholic people.
Yeah.
But you would encounter lots of Catholic people who you know, don't know anything about the teachings of their church, and they don't really, I mean, it wouldn't play as big of a role in influencing how do they make their decisions throughout the day. And partly, I think the reason is because of a different attitude about the priesthood of all believers,
right.
Which is a very serious doctrine for Mennonites and Anabaptists.
Right.
If you're a part of this congregation, then you have a really important role to play as a minister to your family and as a minister to the other people that are here in this church.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm trying to say is like not to like try to present a claim here that the Orthodox aren't doing anything wrong, but rather to paint it in a light of like, well, be really careful before you start throwing stones at somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not perfect either.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree, and my experience is most Orthodox clergy also agree that there is a problem within their churches of people not taking it seriously sometimes. mm-hmm. of people just going through the motions. And, you know, so that can be a fair criticism, but that doesn't mean like the entire tradition is garbage, so you should throw it out and want nothing to do with it. Like I see it as a tradition that's is like in a place where it's constantly having to navigate this difficult position of you have an externally Christian culture, and then you also have the high demands of Christ, and how do you put those two things together? And it's not always an easy question to answer. And it's like a question that has to constantly be reassessed and readdressed and revisited. And you know, in the long history of the church, that's always the question that we've had to reassess and readdress. And you know, sometimes we fail to address that question and slip into a period where just, you know, nobody's really taking it seriously.
Okay, let's get back to the experience of the Orthodox Church. Yeah. So,
well, here's a question that I'll ask both of you: is what from our experience visiting the Orthodox Church, what is something that stood out to you as something that we could learn from as Mennonites, or something that could inform our way of
Yeah, I was trying to move in that direction a little bit when I said, you know, our architecture also has a message, mm-hmm. and it's less plain. But I don't have a specific application for like,
yeah,
how do you communicate that more effectively? And actually, the only thing that comes to mind is like maybe if out in your foyer you have a little more decoration, so that when you come into the sanctuary, the lack of decoration is more striking. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I don't know that that would fly necessarily.
Yeah.
So that was my effort to move in that direction.
Yeah.
So I mentioned this idea of sacredness, and the other thing that I want to mention is a sense of ancientness. And when you're a part of that Orthodox service, well, to me, I feel like, you know, We can, in a very scholarly way, trace back the origins of different parts of the liturgy. You know, like this prayer that they recite goes back at least to this date, and this prayer goes back to this date. And you can see hundreds and you know, 1,500 years of history in some of these things. And they're doing these, for those who wouldn't be familiar, you'd be chanting a lot of these things together as a congregation, or there'd be people in the front that would be singing through these things, or in some cases, you would all be singing them together with the whole congregation. And almost no talking during the service. Mm-hmm. And there was one long passage that they were reading at the very beginning, and every other passage of scripture was, everything else was sung with a real short homily, which was, I think, shorter than usual in the service that we attended.
Mm-hmm.
But so almost no talking at all.
Yeah, but like even as far as a short homily, like a normal homily length in like a liturgy would be like 10 or 15 minutes. So like relative to a Protestant or Mennonite sermon, you know, we might have half an hour, 45 minutes mm-hmm. of preaching.
Yeah.
But instead their service is focused on prayer. Like prayer, like putting prayer and worship in a place above teaching and preaching.
Yeah.
Which, you know,
well, I did want to comment with in terms of ancientness before we, you know, go on that route, that although some of these things you can date and see where they come from in Christian history, standing in there and being present in it, like you sort of have this feeling of like, oh no, this is the experience of ancient humanity, yeah. what they're doing right here. Like you feel like, although this is very, very Christian, there's also something that just seems like it's much older than Christianity, the chanting together and the singing together. And you can see, I mean, it's when you go back to pre-Christian times in history, then everything is so cloudy.
Yeah.
And any scholar who's into like Jewish temple practices just ultimately just wishes that we knew more than what we yeah. did about ancient Jewish practices.
Right.
But you know, there's this feeling of like something of that has definitely made it through this line.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, is like, what you'll find when you look at those scholars is they'll pretty much always all come back and say the best witness actually that we have of Second Temple era Jewish practice are Christian. Mm-hmm. Like the liturgies, the liturgical traditions of, you know, Orthodox, Catholic, Anglican, these different branches of Christianity that use an old form of liturgy, like the core parts of their worship system and their worship services can pretty much all be traced back to Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And like you mentioned, you know, you can date this or that song or this or that passage back to a certain date, but the basic structure is something that at this point we've been able to date to the first century. So it's like we have pretty good evidence that like this is the basic pattern of worship of the first Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that they carried over from Judaism.
Yeah.
I guess we don't need to get too far into that. We're not here to talk about
liturgy. Yeah, no, I mean, but there is something, you know, like by comparison, whether you're an Anabaptist or whether you're a more typical Protestant, so I'll call Anabaptist atypical Protestants in this discussion.
Yeah.
Your sense of history mostly goes back to the 1500s, and the songs that you sing in church, pretty much, they're not going to be older than that. And in fact, for the most part, you'll have a couple from the 1700s that have been standards that have survived, but most of what you sing in church is like 150 years old, and that's if you're singing traditional music, it still falls in a very short window.
Right.
So it's hard to even call it traditional when it's that short of a time span. When you're talking like 150 year history versus a 1500 year history, so with that, there's this sense that you're not really participating in a community with the saints, with the Christians who were walking this earth prior to the 1500s, with the Orthodox Church service. Then you do have this sense that now I don't want to get too orthodox sounding in theology, you know, I'm talking about like prayer to, I'm not trying to make a point about praying to saints or anything like that, but just communion, the great cloud of witnesses, like you can sense that you are a part of that in that service, and it's very, very difficult to feel that, especially, you know, I mentioned traditional hymns that go back 150 years, but of course in a lot of Christian services, it goes back 15 years, so
yes, right.
To like these, keep dividing it by 10, but it's just very difficult to, like, you just begin to sort of feel like you're alone when you feel like it's, the worship that I'm involved in is only the worship that's shared with these people that are right here, and anybody who listens to the same radio station that we do, but it doesn't reach back to my grandparents and my great-grandparents, and it doesn't reach back to the centuries before them.
Well, like, in tying that together with talking about the sacred space, is like, if you look around in that space in the nave of the church, you know, the main worship area. This particular church was a dome, and the, you know, the main area is, I guess it was probably octagonal, maybe it was circular, or maybe it was kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think the outer was circular and the inner was kind of octagonal.
Yeah, maybe. That sounds right. But like, so what you have on like the bottom row, I guess kind of at ground level, is these images of, I don't know, dozens of different saints.
Mm-hmm.
And then above that, you had, I think above that, there were pictures of stories from the Old Testament. And then above that, there were pictures of stories from the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And then above that, there were pictures of angels. And then finally, at the top of the dome, there's this big, huge image of Christ in heaven.
Right, yeah.
And the whole idea of that is,
it's like, we're one big story. I mean, for the Protestant, you have, like, here's the story of the Bible, and then skip skip a couple of not a couple of centuries, but skip a, you know, well, 1500 years. Well,
yeah.
I hate that it's the same number because I'm going from a different direction now. Yeah. But jump ahead 1500 years, and then we have some stories from right here.
Right.
And then you don't need to worry too much about the next couple hundred years, and then we have you and your friends.
Right.
And that's the Christian stories. The Bible, the people in the 1500s, and you and your friends.
Yes. Yeah, and then in contrast, you enter this space, and it's like very clearly stated in the architecture and in the art and in how they worship that what they're saying is, we aren't worshiping just now in this moment,
mm-hmm.
in the time of the world outside. We are joining in to a worship service that has been going on since the creation of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we're joining in worship with Christ himself, with all the angels, all of the, you know, the apostles, the patriarchs,
mm-hmm.
And all of these saints. It's like, that's why they have the saints around their church. It's like they're saying, we're joining in the worship that has been ongoing since the foundation of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
And I think I like what you said there, David. That's kind of what, well, I guess, you know, like my impressions or what I took away from it was, you know, what I would like to see, or what I kind of, you know, took from it is being able to inform our own approaches as Mennonites is something along the lines of, you know, where can we bring some sacredness back into our practice? Where can we bring the, you know, where can we bring the connection to, you know, early Christianity back into the way we're approaching things? Because, you know, you just said it a little bit ago, John, like it feels as though there's not much of a connection at all in so many ways. And you guys have talked a little bit about people leaving, you know, Protestantism or leaving Mennonite churches and going to the Orthodox Church. And I think that's probably one of the primary reasons is they're going to a place where they feel like there is actually a connection to something.
Yeah, and like they want to be part of something bigger.
Yeah, something bigger and beyond.
Yeah, you know, people
just
use
now.
That phrase, you want to be something part of it bigger than yourself. It's like also you want your community to be part
right.
of something bigger than itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like you there's this like this inherent danger in this system of, you know, going after people that worship the way that you want or people that teach the things that you want is like, well, this is not something that endures. Because like you're living in the moment. And there's something to me that's very appealing to the thought that worship was something that was established at the creation of heaven and earth and has been ongoing ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing when we come to worship God isn't something that we're doing on our own. Rather, we're stepping into that worship. And like my own research has uncovered that like this is the whole project behind the development of Christian liturgy over the first couple centuries of Christianity and also in Judaism before Christianity. It's like this is the whole idea they have, is they're looking at the prophets, like especially Ezekiel, and then they're looking at the book of Revelation and they're saying, oh, this is showing us how worship is happening in heaven. And so we're going to do the same.
Yeah, it for me, I guess, you know, experiencing it, experiencing their service, or experiencing, I guess it was, you could call it a, you know, a partial liturgy, or, you know, a shorter version of what the liturgy would be. It was a Sunday evening, a Vespers. Yeah, Sunday evening Vespers, Forgiveness
right.
Sunday, or whatever is what they call it. But it was, it kind of struck me with the idea that our Anabaptist ancestors used to practice some sort of a liturgical type of, you know, service. Like it used to be a thing that our ancestors practiced. And I guess the question that, you know, we can ask ourselves is, you know, where did we get away from that? Why did we? And what can we maybe do to start reincorporating some of those things? I'm not suggesting, obviously, you know, these things changed over the course of generations, and I think they will change in the other direction over the course of generations as well. But where can we open ourselves up to some of that? Because
I think the easiest, I know you've looked into this a little more, but I don't think there's a whole lot of real knowledge out there of what was a traditional Anabaptist liturgy. You know, I mean, if it were possible to dig it out of our own tradition, then it would be much easier to say, hey, this is what our people did. And then there's just something much more natural about incorporating that or reincorporating that into your tradition than there is in saying, well, hey, look what the Orthodox people are doing now. Let's try to do something kind of like that, because that feels very phony and grafted on. And if you're you know, the pastor of the church and you're trying to do something like that, then people are just going to feel like, why are you imposing this outside tradition on us?
Right. Yeah.
But if, you know, if it comes from our own history, then like, I mean, it's just a totally different ballgame. Like, now you're giving a gift to them. You're connecting them with their heritage in a way that they had lost, which is something that people deeply appreciate.
Yeah. One of the things, another thing I will say about my experience and my impression is that, you know, as a pastor myself in the Mennonite Church, one of the things that we normally do, you know, in our services now is we have a preaching service, which usually lasts anywhere from half hour, 45 minutes, like David mentioned. And one of the things that was really impressed on me in visiting the Orthodox service is that the preaching was the very last thing that happened.
Yeah.
And it was not very long at all. It was very brief. It was not the focal point of the service or whatever at all.
The only thing I remember about it was that he said he wasn't going to talk very long.
Yeah. Before I forget what I was going to say, just let me finish and then you can get to your thought. But
no, I want to talk now.
what stuck with me out of that was, where did we, you know, how did we as the Anabaptists get to a point where the preaching became more of a focal point instead of prayer and corporate worship being more of a focal point? And
that's a very good point, because like, I don't know a whole lot about the Dutch tradition, I guess, like, just to be honest and open, like I've never really had much interest in it because I have no connection to it. But I do know quite a lot about the Swiss tradition, because that's my background. And what you'll find in the early Swiss tradition is like the emphasis was on prayer and praying together. And like, there's also like this huge emphasis that, you know, you come together, you know, if you don't have, you know, a bishop present to serve communion or a teacher present to teach, you still come together, but what you come together to do is to pray and collectively read the scripture. And like, I look at that, and like every time I encounter that, it's just like, whoa, like that is not how we do this today. And like, prayer in the 1500s means something very, very different than what coming together for prayer means today. Like, we have over time adopted, I guess I would say, like a very Protestant, but I would say like English Protestant idea of what prayer is, that would have been like completely foreign and alien to our Anabaptist ancestors. That to them, prayer would have been something that's structured, it's something that you participate in together. And you know, like, we have a number of Anabaptist prayer books from the 1500s.
And a lot of those prayers, by the way, are not unlike some Orthodox prayers you would hear. Because I use some of them.
They're also quite long, generally speaking. And like, they were not like, so like the Amish would still use one of the old 1500s Anabaptist prayer books. And they'll often use it, you know, like this is what they'll use to pray at home. I don't think that's what it was originally intended for. I think these were originally intended as prayers to be used in your collective meetings, your collective gatherings, because like there was a short, there was always a shortage of teachers, there was always a shortage of bishops, but they still stressed you come together to pray, to worship, and to read the scripture, mm-hmm. whenever you can. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure when things changed for us, but my suspicion is that it happened in America because we spent, you know, a long time not really having the luxury of being able to develop a mature tradition. And then when we get to America, we have that availability, but that by that point we're centuries cut off from where we started. And so we kind of have to build something from the ground up, and we're surrounded by Protestants. So we just kind of adopt their mode of worship.
Okay, we're running pretty long. I think we want to wrap this up, but I want to try to conclude in a way that addresses Aaron's question that he asked. It seems like some of what we draw, and I'm just pulling this basically from your conversation and maybe some things I said a long time ago. but what we would want to draw from a tradition or from that experience ultimately means like figuring out what we draw from our own tradition. Yeah. And that means lots of prayer and reading of scripture. And if you're going to do lots of corporate prayer, then it does have to have some sense of structure to it.
Right.
And we do have those materials, as you said. We've got the old prayer books. If we're interested in tapping into that, that exists in written form for us, easy to access those things. So there's the sense of sacredness, which I think it's very easy for us to treat our rituals in the Mennonite Church as something that's sacred. Our communion has always been something that it's hard to express in a few short lines like how sacred and how significant that communion was regarded as. And it's not something that we did often, typically, but when communion time was coming, you might spend weeks preparing for it, and that includes asking for forgiveness of anyone that you wronged, healing whatever divides exist between you and your neighbor before you're fit to take that communion meal. Mm-hmm. And certainly the foot washing ceremony as well, which is less widely practiced, but it's really good. I mean, I don't want to get into too much of that right now because we've got a long service on our hands. But there is something very special in the foot washing tradition as well. But even aside from those traditions, there's also, and again, this is not practiced by all Anabaptists, but the head covering that's on every woman in the church is a sacred sign. And then you've also got just buttoning up your shirt in the morning is like I'm preparing myself for a sacred act today. And that's just a matter of mindset, I think, to say like treat that as something that's sacred. Mm-hmm. Although if you're dressing in a way that nobody else in the world dresses, then it does make it a lot easier to regard that as something sacred, as like preparing yourself for sacred activity.
Yeah, I mean, the flip side of that is like it's also very easy for those things to just become empty traditions that have no meaning. And like, and I'll just real briefly say to that, like that's something that struck me in that church that we were in, is it's a very traditional church, like even more traditional than the most traditional Anabaptist group.
Mm-hmm.
Because they literally have not changed the way they've done things for 1,500 years.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, you could look around and see people like seriously connecting to the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Like not just going through the motions. And I'm sure there were some people there that were just going through the motions. It's probably also true that the service that we were at, that the people that were gonna go to that service were people that wanted to be there. So it was probably more representative of the people that take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like,
It is striking to enter into a traditional setting, but to see people not just treating it as tradition.
Yeah, but to me this is, you know, and another thing that I didn't mention is sacred language, which you could see that. I mean, there were multiple languages that were incorporated into the service because it's mostly in English, but then they have there are different, well, I was going to say Latin, but I don't know if there was Greek.
So they had Greek, Greek and Arabic.
Yeah. Because
the original people from the church were from Syria, so they're Arabic speaking people, just so obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Only the reason I was almost to say Latin is because the Greek that they used is used in Latin services also, even though it's Greek.
Right.
Okay, but that's an aside. So you have like multiple languages in there, and people have pretty well like stopped using German, Mennonite churches anyways,
mm-hmm.
Have stopped using German as a sacred language. A lot of the English speaking world used King James English as a sacred language,
right.
And the reason that it has fallen out of favor is not because people got to the point where it was too archaic and you couldn't understand it, because it was always archaic.
Right.
It was always elevated language and not the way that people spoke in normal life. Mm-hmm. The reason it's fallen out of favor is because people have rejected the sacredness of it.
Yeah.
They've rejected the idea that you would speak differently in the presence of God than what you would speak, you know, in front of your friends at school.
Right.
But I don't know, that's also, you know, maybe that's something else to consider in terms of how do you make your religious service something that's sacred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have one other thing that I wanted to say, but I think I'll leave it for now because it could launch into a whole other discussion, but I will mention what it was, which is just like the incorporation of like actually practicing the thing instead of teaching about it,
mm-hmm.
instead of, you know, just talking about it, but like actually like demonstrating and allow people to participate in here's how you actually be the Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking a lot about my grandpa lately in my music performances, just I kind of have like this little mini set that's dealing with him. And I kind of get to this almost awkward place where I want to talk of, I'm not like going into any kind of detail about what I gained from my grandpa, but I feel like there's this sense in which people are going to expect me to say, he taught me a lot. And I don't think my grandpa taught me anything. but I got from him something that was a lot more valuable than teaching,
mm-hmm.
and he was a type of role model that that doesn't walk the earth anymore.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how else to say that. Like, but certainly, like, I mean, I've got a very positive relationship with Dad, you know, and lots of things that I've learned from him. But like, but there's a kind of essence of my grandfather that is the essence of a generation that's gone.
Right.
Did you say his walk taught? His walk?
Oh, yeah.
Teaching?
Right. But it's like, it's different than teaching, you know? Like, yeah. you're talking about getting in front of the church and preaching the sermon and thinking that's the important thing. But it's like,
right.
This guy was a major, major influence on my life, and it wasn't because...
Yeah, he like never said
that. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's not teaching that really transforms people, and that like it's not teaching that you model yourself after.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that was a good discussion, and if you, as our audience, have anything that stands out to you, any ideas yourself, maybe you've been to visit an Orthodox church or a service like that, or any other,
or a Mennonite church.
Yeah. Or maybe you think, you know, you're wondering why we would do that. Like, we enjoy those questions too. Like,
yeah.
Those valuable questions.
Yeah. Or if you have ideas about, like, you know, the question we pose, you know, how can we incorporate more sacredness into the service that we have as Mennonites. Offer your ideas in the comments and your questions, anything.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're kind of covering this, but when you've looked at another tradition and you've seen they have something to offer me, those would be nice stories to hear.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us today, and we wish you peace in Christ.